Before David Barsamian speaks, let me say one thing, because David will be too modest to mention this. He wrote an excellent article on this topic of this panel in the October issue of Z Magazine. So I would urge you all, if you're interested in these issues, a very an excellent article that David will be too modest to mention, probably. So that issue is being given away. Is that true, Mike? For free? If any are left, it's being given away for free right outside. It's right there, so the gentleman's holding it up. Okay, so David.
Thank you. And if anyone would like the complete unedited version, you can come up to get copies or give me your name and address, and I'll send you one. Sorry? Yes, there is editing at Z. This is a news flash. Actually, the article is in detail about public radio and public broadcasting, community radio in Pacifica, but it's really a case study in the dis-ease and dysfunction in the progressive movement, and that's where that is located. A lack of a media strategy, a lack of a vision of what a democratic society would look like, one where we'd like to live in, and also a communications policy. What are the communication needs of a democratic society? Well, I think very significantly, next year is the 50th anniversary of the United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Article 19, let me read it to you. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. I think that's a very powerful and meaningful statement, and something that we should be advancing on, not just our individual agendas, but on our collective agendas as well. And particularly the last statement, which I'm going to Indian raga, take a spin off this, regardless of frontiers. I'm encountering these frontiers in my work in community radio as well as in national public radio, and encountering electronic barriers, encountering boundaries, ideological boundaries, where what is permissible, what can be spoken, what can be heard, and what can't be heard. For example, the news editor and host of All Things Considered, National Public Radio's premier news magazine, which began in 1971, Bob Siegel, he said he wasn't particularly interested in what Noam Chomsky had to say. The premier intellectual figure of this era, who is acknowledged as such outside our borders, our ideological borders. But the host of All Things Considered is not particularly interested, and Chomsky has been on, I believe, three times in the 25 years of National Public Radio's existence. So if you tune in every 8 years, folks, you might hear... I'm talking about National Public Radio. Okay. What I'm encountering is an ideological mindset of skittishness, milquetoastishness, and fear and timidity among the gatekeepers. At each one of these stations, I and other independents and other endangered species have to deal with these program directors or station managers. Usually it's one person, sometimes it's as many as two, who decide what you, the audience, gets to hear. And many of these people have almost like Politburo tenure. There's very little turnover. It's a shrinking industry. There's not a lot of jobs being created in public radio, at National Public Radio as well. And this influences still further timidity, a lack of risk-taking, a lack of wanting to step out of bounds and challenge the status quo. And I'm not saying, and this is my pitch to NPR stations, I'm not saying that what I produce is the cat's meow, but it's one meow that deserves to be heard. And there is an audience there increasingly for diverse points of view, for different perspectives. So as my colleagues and friends at FAIR say, the spectrum at National Public Radio now, you know, we used to joke, it used to be A to Z, and now it's A to P, but now it's about A to AP, AB. It's increasingly declining. What's the evidence for that? Okay, I mean, we could just have rhetorical flashes here. But we have, you know, we study this stuff, and we have proof. For example, less than 7 or 8 years ago, Michael Harrington was a regular commentator on National Public Radio, one of the premier democratic socialists in the United States. That kind of view is nowhere to be heard. Molly Ivins, whatever you may think of her, I think she's a liberal Democrat. She's very funny. She reaches lots of people. She's a nationally syndicated columnist. She was a regular commentator on NPR, not to be heard. Erwin Knoll, the former editor of the Progressive, another voice. None of these people, when they moved on or whatever happened, were replaced by comparable voices. Instead, we have people like David Frum and pundits from the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, the Golden Rolodex, that not just NPR feeds off of, but all of these networks live off this trough of intellectual manure. And so that partly explains that. Let me just give you another example of how constricted and constrained NPR has become. I had the unfortunate opportunity to attend the Public Radio Program Directors Conference in Denver a couple of weeks ago. A couple of people in the audience were there as well. I had the lack of good manners, I'm sorry I didn't go to finishing school and I never finished college, to bring up the Carnegie Commission report. 30 years ago, a very radical document was produced in this country called the Carnegie Commission report. It had such, well-known Marxist-Leninists as the president of Harvard University, the head of MIT, even the head of Polaroid, and on and on. I mean, we're talking like the creme de la creme of the East Coast establishment produced a document in which they laid out another vision of what public broadcasting could be in the United States. Can the programming I'm quoting here can help us see America whole in all its diversity, serve as a forum for controversy and debate, and provide a voice for groups that may otherwise be unheard. That's from the Carnegie Commission report. Hardly anyone at that conference in Denver knew what I was even referring to when I mentioned it. I sort of injected that into one public forum. Now, I must say, while PBS, which was directly formed from that Carnegie Commission report, and National Public Radio, which spun off a couple of years later, the idea that the Carnegie Commission had to fund this new entity, public radio and public TV in the United States, was to provide an insulated heat shield from political pressure, guaranteed funding in advance, 3 to 5 years in advance, not subject to congressional committees, congressional votes, and the vagaries of the political climate. Well, Wilbur Mills, who was a very powerful Southern Democrat from Arkansas at the time, was head of the House Appropriations Committee, he absolutely refused on this single point of providing that insulated funding for public radio and public TV. So the system, and Johnson went along with it because he needed war funding for Indochina, and Mills had his tap on the purse strings as the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, to give you a little historical background. So Johnson conceded, everyone forgot about that, and now this system had structurally a built-in flaw that it was subjected to political pressure. You didn't have to wait long to see how it would play out. There was a PBS documentary on banks in the United States and corruptions in the banking industry, and Nixon went ballistic and vetoed the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding in 1972. And you've seen it go up and down. It hit another fever pitch in 95 with the Contractors on America who came to power, and Newt Gingrich denouncing PBS and NPR as a sandbox for the elite. And Dole was sick and tired of the unrelenting liberal cheerleading that was on PBS. I'm sure he had William F. Buckley in mind, and John McLaughlin, and the other, you know, left-wing voices that completely dominate public broadcasting, both NPR as well as PBS. I mean, when you look at the evidence measured against the right-wing rhetoric, I mean, it's laughable on its face. Now, these are not, as the right wing and the dominant ideology would have us like to subscribe to, we're not talking about abstract forces here like the market or globalization or technology. These are not coming from external forces. And I think there is a broad-based movement in this country. As Irvish Yved, who is one of my heroes, said about an hour and a half ago, we've got to figure out ways to pull people together. And we're going to pull people together when we start talking to the congregation in the language of the congregation. I love you all. I'm really glad you're here. You're the choir. You're converted. You know, and I'm glad to reach you, but I'm really interested in a broader media and political strategy that will reach the congregation. Thank you.